So good afternoon. Welcome to the 497th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. The forum has been meeting monthly since 1983 to hear an invited speaker on a topic central to U.S. foreign policy. Today we're pleased to have Ambassador Steve Pfeiffer speaking on the Russia-Ukraine war, negotiated settlement, or continued fighting. Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer is an affiliate of Stanford University's Center for International Security and Cooperation and a non-resident senior fellow with the Brookings Institution. He was a William J. Perry Research Fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation from 2018 to 2022 and a fellow at the Robert Bosch Academy in Berlin from January to May of 2021. Ambassador Pfeiffer is a retired Foreign Service officer with more than 25 years with the State Department focused on U.S. relations with the former Soviet Union and Europe, as well as arms control and security issues. He has previously served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs with responsibilities for Russia and Ukraine, as the first U.S. ambassador to Ukraine after the breakup of the Soviet Union, and as a special assistant to the president and senior director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. He also served in the Foreign Service in Warsaw, Moscow, and London, and was on the U.S. delegation to the negotiation on intermediate-range nuclear forces in Geneva, a treaty which unfortunately is now no longer with us. He is the author of The Eagle and the Trident, U.S.-Ukraine Relations in Turbulent Times, published by the Brookings Institution Press, and co-author of The Opportunity, Next Steps in Reducing Nuclear Arms, also published by the Brookings Institution Press. Ambassador Pfeiffer is a 1976 graduate of Stanford University with a bachelor's degree in economics. Steve, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Well, George, thank you for that kind introduction, and thank you for the invitation to speak today. It's now been about 4.5 years since Russia's major assault turned the Russia-Ukraine conflict into the largest and bloodiest war that Europe has seen since World War II ended in 1945. The war is clearly not going as the Kremlin hoped or expected, and I think what we've seen over the past 4 years is that the Ukrainians have surprised the world. I'm going to talk about three things today. First of all, the background of the conflict. Second, I'll talk about what's happened on the battlefield. And then third, I'll talk about negotiations and their prospects. But let me first ask the question, why should Americans care? This is a map of Ukraine. It's 5,000 miles away. We have a very busy foreign policy plate. We have to deal, for example, with the rise of the China challenge. So let me give you a couple reasons why I think what happens in Ukraine matters to the United States. First of all, for more than 7 decades, American leaders, with the notable exception of one, have defined a stable and secure Europe as a vital American national security interest. If the Russians prevail in Ukraine, Europe will be less stable, it will be less secure, and it will require more attention and resources and time taken away from the attention we might otherwise devote to China. But a second reason I think we should care is I do not believe that Vladimir Putin's ambitions necessarily end with Ukraine. In June of 2022, this was about 4 months after the major invasion, Putin was in St. Petersburg. He met with a group of Russian business students, and the question of Peter the Great conquering the Baltic states came up. And Putin said, no. Peter the Great did not conquer the Baltic states. He regained historic Russian territory. Putin went on to compare himself to Peter the Great and suggest that what he was doing in Ukraine was recovering historic Russian territory. Well, this is a map of the Russian Empire at the end of the 18th century. And what you'll see is that not only most of modern-day Ukraine, but Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and a good part of Poland were once part of the Russian Empire. Does Putin consider those 5 countries, all members of NATO now, to be historic Russian territory? And what might he do if he were emboldened by victory in Ukraine? Would he attack a NATO member? I think most Russian experts now would say no, that would be way too risky. And they're probably right, but I would add a qualifier. If you'd asked the same expert, say in 2018, would Putin launch the kind of invasion of Ukraine that he launched in 2022, they would have said no, that would be way too risky. There is risk to underestimating Putin's ambitions, and I think it's best certainly for Ukraine, but also for Europe and the United States, that Putin be stopped in Ukraine. So let me talk a bit about the background. First of all, this war did not begin in 2022. If you go back to 2013, Russia had a Ukrainian neighbor that was officially neutral. Ukrainians were not interested in joining NATO, but they were interested in coming closer to the European Union. And then President Viktor Yanukovych was on the verge of signing an association agreement with the European Union. And Russian officials, who for years, up until at least 2010, 2011, had said they don't care how far Ukraine goes with the European Union, decided that they cared a lot. They put pressure on Yanukovych, and he ended up not signing the agreement. That led to the Maidan Revolution, which then morphed into a broader protest against Yanukovych's epic corruption and also his growing authoritarianism. Following the Maidan Revolution, Yanukovych disappears. He ends up in Moscow a couple of weeks later. But the Ukrainians appoint an acting president and an acting prime minister. They say our number one foreign policy goal is to bring Ukraine closer to the European Union. We will sign the association agreement. And I think that caused panic in Moscow. So the Russian military seizes Crimea in February and early March of 2014. In mid-2014, Russia illegally annexes Crimea. And then about a month later, Russia begin to provoke violence in Donbas. That's the very eastern part of Ukraine that consists of the Donetsk and Luhansk provinces. Now, the Russian takeover of Crimea was pretty much bloodless. There were 11,000 Ukrainian troops on the peninsula, but they largely stayed in garrison. However, when the Russians began to move against eastern Ukraine, the Ukrainians decided they had to act, and there was fighting there. By the end of 2014, that bright red portion, about 40% of Donbas, was occupied by Russian and Russian proxy forces, as well as the Russian occupation of Crimea. And from 2014 until the end of 2021, about 14,000 people were killed in fighting along the line of contact in Donbas. But I think the expectation early 2021 was this was going to be a steady state for Ukraine. Russia maintaining that Crimea was part of Russia, and then Russia using Donbas to ratchet up the violence if it wanted to put pressure on Kyiv, and then ratcheting down in better times. But what you saw beginning in the spring of 2021 was a Russian military exercise along the Russia-Ukraine border. And when that exercise concluded, the troops went back to garrison, but they left a lot of their heavy equipment behind. And that really set the stage for the February 2022 invasion. Vladimir Putin, in this picture here, he gave a speech on February 21, 3 days before the Russians crossed into Ukraine or in the invasion. And he gave three complaints against Ukraine. First, he argued that what Ukraine was doing in trying to regain Donbas constituted genocide against the people of Donbas. I don't think any serious scholar would agree with that. Second, he said that there were Nazis running the Ukrainian government, which is an interesting charge to make against the Ukrainian government, whose president is Jewish. And then he also charged that without evidence that Ukraine was seeking to acquire nuclear weapons. Bear in mind that 30 years ago, Ukraine voluntarily gave up what was the world's third largest nuclear arsenal on its territory. I think those are all bogus reasons. I think there are really three reasons why the Kremlin moved in 2022. One was a concern in the Kremlin that Ukraine was moving perhaps irretrievably out of Moscow's orbit towards the West. And that was happening. But the irony here is that nothing has done more than Russian policy of the past 13 and 14 years to push Ukraine away from Russia and towards the West. The second was a concern in the Kremlin about domestic politics inside of Russia. And that is for the Kremlin. A stable, independent, democratic, and economically successful Ukraine is a nightmare. because that kind of Ukraine will cause Russians to ask why they can't have the same political voice, the same democratic rights that Ukrainians do. And for the Kremlin, job number one is regime preservation. But the third reason is really this guy up on the picture here, Vladimir Putin. He has a very distorted view of Ukraine. Now, if you look at Russia and Ukraine, you have two countries whose history, culture, language, religion has been thoroughly entwined for over 1,000 years. This is a map of Europe at the end of the 10th century, and what you see there is that large gray area, that's Kievan Rus, which is probably the largest empire in Europe at the time. Both Russia and Ukraine claim Kievan Rus as their founding state. In Moscow, they say that Kyiv is the mother of all Russian cities. And part of this war is about history. Now, from 1654 until 1991, with the exception of a couple of chaotic years at the end of World War I, what is modern-day Ukraine, most of that was part of either the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union. But despite that, Ukrainians were one of the peoples of the Soviet Union who in 1990-1991 led the push for independence. In 1991, there was an independence referendum. 92% of the population of Ukraine voted for independence from Moscow. And what was especially interesting to me was Crimea. Crimea is the only part of Ukraine where ethnic Russians were a majority of the population. In Crimea, 54% voted for independence from Moscow. Now, losing an empire is hard. Ukraine was the piece that Russians most did not want to see go away. And it was especially hard for Vladimir Putin, who fundamentally does not accept the right of Ukraine to exist as a sovereign and independent state. And don't take my word for it. You can go, I think it's presidentofrussia.ru, and you can find Putin's essay and the English version of it published in 2021, in which case he makes the case. He looks at Ukraine as basically not an independent, not a different people, wayward Russians who've lost their way. And over the last 4.5 years, he spent a lot of time killing them to try to bring them back into the fold. He thinks that he's now recovering historic Russian territory. I think that's false. This is a war of choice. Ukraine posed no military or security threat to Russia. It really, I think, boils down to a neo-imperialist effort by Vladimir Putin to recover parts of the Russian Empire that were lost to Moscow when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. So let me talk about the course of the war to date. This was the situation on the map here in January of 2022, where the Russians occupied Crimea, and they occupied about 40% of Donbas in the east. This is 4 days into the invasion, and what you can see is the Russians invaded out of Belarus in the north, out of Russia proper in the northeast, out of occupied Donbas in the east, and of occupied Crimea in the south. And those attack vectors suggest that the Russians had two main objectives. One was to capture Kyiv quite quickly and presumably depose the Ukrainian government. The other, though, the broader objective was to occupy the eastern one-half to two-thirds of Ukraine, leaving behind perhaps a small rump Ukrainian state in the west. The Russian advance peaked really at the end of March of 2022. At that point, in the south, the east, and the north, Russian forces occupied about 27% of Ukrainian territory. But the first surprise was in the north, they failed to take Kyiv. The Ukrainians pushed them back, and at the end of March, the beginning of April, the Russians essentially say, we're giving up on Kyiv, we're shifting our attention to Donbas in the east. Over the course of 2022, there were Ukrainian counterattacks. First in Kharkiv in the northeast in August, and they pushed the Russians out of the Kharkiv province. And then in November, the Russians withdrew in the south from the Kherson, from the part of Kherson that was north of the Dnipro River, leading to the map looking like this in November of 2022, with significant amounts of Ukrainian territory liberated by the Russians. Now, the big issue in 2023 was a long-anticipated Ukrainian counteroffensive. And the idea here, and I'll show on the map just briefly, was that the Ukrainians would break through from Zaporizhia, drive south to the Sea of Azov, and basically separate the Russians in the southern part of Ukraine into two blocks, and also sever the land bridge that allowed the Russians to supply Crimea. The Ukrainian counteroffensive failed. I think there were two reasons. One was the Russians had built up a very extensive set of defensive lines, really three lines that you had to break. And the Ukrainians broke two but could not break the third. I think the other problem was that the Ukrainians were under-resourced. They probably did not have all the equipment that they needed. But also, I think they made a tactical mistake, is that they divided their counteroffensive into three directions. And so the drive in the south was not as resourced as it might have been. But really, after that counteroffensive fails, the war becomes really like a World War I war of attrition, with heavy fighting in the trenches. The Russians made some gains in Donbass, but not all that much. And so in the summer of 2025, this is what the map looks like. The Russians have taken a little bit more of Donbass, but that's about it. And really, since that a year ago, they have made very little progress. In fact, this year, Ukrainian counterattacks have virtually offset Russian territorial gains. Now, I was last in Kyiv in April, and what struck me was the confidence level of Ukrainians compared to earlier trips I'd made in 2024 and 2025. And I think there were several reasons for their confidence. One is, at that point, it was about 6 weeks into the Russian spring offensive in Donbass, and the Russians were not making much progress. And that's continued. They made a little bit of progress, but not very much in Donbass. A second reason, though, was the Ukrainians have developed defenses against Russian drones. So this handheld device there, that's a Stinger Ukrainian drone. It costs about $2,000 to $3,000 to make. These have been very effective in shooting down long-range Russian drones. Probably the Ukrainians now shoot down about 85 to 90% of them. This compares very favorably with the Gulf War, where instead of a $2,000 device, Arab states were using $4 million Patriots to shoot down Iranian drones. On the battlefield, this is a battlefield drone. The Ukrainians have really saturated the battlefield with reconnaissance and attack drones. And basically, 30 kilometers into the line of contact, you know, what they were basically telling us was that if we see a Russian soldier or Russian equipment, we can put a weapon on that within a matter of minutes. And the bigger change that we began to see about a year and a half ago was Ukraine's ability to do attack targets deep inside of Russia, as far now as 2,000 kilometers. That's about 12 to 1,300 miles inside of Russia. Now, I think the Russians, usually having a lot of territory is an advantage. But in a air defense world, it means you have to defend a lot of territory. And the Russians aren't able to defend much outside of the line of contact or Moscow. And even in Moscow, they fail. This is a oil refinery on fire in Moscow. It was attacked by the Ukrainians, I think, about 2 months ago. It's 10 kilometers from the Kremlin. What you may have seen in the press is the Ukrainians now have begun attacking wild berries. That's the Russian equivalent of Amazon, but the Russians also use that to move some supplies to their forces in Ukraine. And they've now destroyed, I think, 7 of the 10 largest wild berry warehouses in Russia. And that's what that's doing, is beginning to affect Russian logistics. What you've seen also, though, in the last 3 or 4 months is the Ukrainians introducing new drones that are effective from 30 to 150 kilometers out. And that's giving them the ability really to attack and destroy Russian logistic chains to supply their troops at the front. And they've also used that to make progress in isolating Crimea. The other area, I think, for confidence, and I'll come back to it in a bit, is the Europeans have really stepped up in the past 6 months. But I will say Ukraine still faces major challenges. First of all, they have a manpower shortage, and I'll return to that subject. But also, while they can defend against Russian drones, and they also quite successfully can defend against Russian cruise missiles, they need American Patriot interceptors to deal with things like Russian Iskander ballistic missiles. And they're running very, very low. So you have pictures like this. This is an apartment building hit a few weeks ago inside of Kyiv, where the Ukrainians really don't have the ability to engage those systems. Now today, Russia occupies about 19% of Ukraine. That's 1/3 less than they occupied back in March of 2022. And the Russians have paid a huge cost for this. The estimate now is 1.4 million Russian soldiers killed or seriously wounded in action. The British government estimates of those number 500,000 have been killed. When I was in Kyiv in April, the Ukrainian at the Minister of Defense said, we are killing or seriously ending about 35,000 Russian troops per month. And I was struck because they gave us a very exact number. They said like 35,122. And I asked the colonel, I said, how can you be that sure? And he basically said, 90% of casualties are inflicted by drones. We have the video, we have the photographs. And I've seen these, I mean, you basically see these videos until right before it detonates. Not only are the Russians losing people, but the Russians have had major equipment losses. So this gives you an idea of major equipment losses by the Russians in the last 4.5 years. I would just note that Oryx is very conservative. They do not count a piece of equipment as destroyed unless they see it visually on a picture and go through their archives and make sure it's not been destroyed previously. But I would also note that when they say 4,390 Russian tanks, that includes probably 2/3 of Russia's modern tanks. They're now forced to basically bring tanks that were in reserve, tanks built 60 years ago, to replace those losses. So you have these major losses, and I think for a war in which Russia's made relatively little progress in the past 2.5 years. Now, the war is fought not just in the air and on land, it's also fought at sea. And here's what had been one of the big surprises. Ukraine has basically won the battle for the Black Sea. When the war began, Ukraine's Navy had a single surface combatant of any size. They scuttled it on day 5 of the war to prevent its capture by the Russians. But what they've done is they've used surface-to-surface missiles. They have used unmanned sea drones to sink or badly damage about 33 ships in the Russian Navy. So that top left picture there, that's the Moskva. It was the flagship of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. It was struck by 2 Ukrainian anti-ship missiles in April of 2022. Hours later, it sank. Bottom right, that's the Sergei Koltov. It's a patrol vessel. You can see it's already been hit by 1 Ukrainian sea drone in the stern. And Ukraine has used this really to push the Black Sea Fleet of Russia back to the east. So although Sevastopol in Crimea is by far the best harbor, the Russians don't use it there because Sevastopol is too easily targeted. But even though they've relocated the bulk of their ships back to Novorossiysk in Russia proper, you may have seen last week the Ukrainians attacked Novorossiysk and damaged 4 Russian warships there. So the Ukrainians are actually doing quite well in the sea battle. Now, the Kremlin clearly expected a quick win here. And there's a lot of evidence suggesting they did not believe that that the Ukrainians would fight. One Russian general reportedly said that he understood that the Kremlin was told when Russian forces cross the line, 70% of Ukrainians will welcome them as liberators. That didn't happen. So why miscalculations? I don't think the Kremlin understands Ukraine. Vladimir Putin's last time in Kyiv was in the summer of 2013, and he gave a speech there in which he said, "We Russians and Ukrainians are one people." And that's a tone-deaf speech to give in Kyiv, because a lot of ethnic Ukrainians are going to hear, "You just denied my language, my culture, my history." A second problem for Putin is he has a very closed inner circle. And admission in that circle is not based on competence, it's based on loyalty. And there's a lot of evidence that suggests it's an echo chamber, and a lot of reporting suggesting that the Russian military actually reports gains that they're making that do not reflect the reality on the battlefield. But I think the biggest issue is maybe Putin himself. He's now been president or prime minister of Russia for 26 years, more than 26 years, and I think he feels he's seen it all. There's a certain arrogance of power that he's not inclined to take views that disagree with his own instincts. So at this point in time on the battlefield, I think the sides have various challenges. For the Ukrainians, it's a manpower challenge. Part of it is because of their policy. Ukraine does not draft men aged 18 to 25. And that's because they're concerned about their demographic future. They want to protect that cadre. So that they don't go into a strong demographic decline. The other challenge that they have is that keeping the flow of Western money and arms is critical. Although I would say it's now more critical to keep Western money coming as opposed to arms, because this war is very different from 2022 and 2023. In the first couple of years after the Russian invasion, Ukraine needed Western artillery shells, tanks, armored personnel carriers. Now it's a war fought mainly with drones. Ukraine produces about 60% of their own weapons. And this year, the goal is to build 9 million drones. Many built in factories like this here where you see assembling. But drone assembly in Ukraine is also a cottage industry. Some may have seen an article about 5 weeks ago in the New York Times where it talked about a group of Ukrainian women. And in America, they might get together to play bridge and gossip, or quiltingly, in Ukraine, they get together for 3 hours a week and they gossip and they build drones. And this is, I think, really created a situation where the Ukrainians are actually getting to the point, when I was in Kyiv in April, they're saying, there are so many drone producers, they actually may have to start consolidating because they're getting to the point where the production exceeds the Ukrainian military's needs. But the big challenge for the Ukrainians still remains how to handle ballistic missiles. And absent American Patriot interceptors, it's a pretty dire situation for the Ukrainians. On the Russian side, I think the Russians are now beginning to have manpower issues. The large bonuses that they offered are not attracting the numbers that they would hope. And there are rumors that after the Russian parliamentary elections in September, Putin may try to mobilize manpower and forcibly draft people. And that could provoke an interesting reaction from the Russian people. I think there's also a question now is that the Russian view of this war may be changing because the civilian economy is taking big hits. This is a gas lines that we saw over the summer in Russia as a result of Ukrainian attacks on Russian oil refineries. And there's kind of a vibe shift. You now see in polling Russia saying 60% of the Russian population thinks that the Russian economy is in trouble. And the Ukrainian attacks on military targets and economic targets deep inside of Russia are really undermining Putin's narrative. Because Putin from the beginning in 2022 said, this is not a war. If you call this a war in Russia, you can go to jail for discrediting the Russian military. It is a special military operation. It is limited, and it will have limited impact on you here in Russia. Well, Russians are beginning to see that. In fact, no, it's going to have an impact on their lives. And I thought there was a very interesting observation. The Economist had an interview with an unnamed former Russian official, and I thought his most salient observation was he said, a year ago, this was our war against Ukraine. Today, it's his war, it's Putin's war. Now, I'm not sure the population turning against it, you know, can stop it, but I think it definitely complicates Putin's desire to continue the war. Now, I think Ukraine's military goals at this point are four. They want to hold the defensive lines, and they seem to be doing quite well at that. They want to do what they can to inflict more casualties. The former defense minister said his goal was 50,000 Russian soldiers killed per month, his prediction being there was no way that Russia could, in fact, make up for that, and that would begin to increase the pain that might cause a change of attitudes in the Kremlin. They want to disrupt Russian logistics, and they're looking at more ways to bleed the Russian economy. I would say at this point, in the last 6 months, Ukraine has the initiative on the battlefield, but there is a big question, can they sustain it? They cannot be complacent. They face a large opponent that has shown the ability to adapt. And this is going to be a very difficult winter for them. Last winter was very, very hard. Russians targeted heating and power facilities to basically weaponize the winter against the civilians, and the Russians can be expected to do the same thing. So let me turn, that's kind of the situation on the battlefield. Let me turn to the negotiation process. There were negotiations between the Russians and Ukrainians back in March of 2022, but they never really concluded any kind of agreement. They agreed on some points. The Ukrainian attitude towards negotiations changed at the end of March of 2022, and that was because as they liberated towns north of Kyiv, like Bucha and Irpin, they saw the results of Russian occupation. In 30 days of Russian occupation of Bucha, 550 civilians were killed. They found organized torture chambers, and I think the Ukrainian government attitude hardened, in part because the public attitude hardened on negotiations. Now, Putin made several demands in 2022. He called for denazification, the replacement of the Ukrainian government. He said Ukraine should be demilitarized, that Ukraine's military should have no more than 80,000 personnel, at a time when Russia was building a military of 1.5 million. He said Ukraine should be permanently neutral, Ukraine must recognize Crimea as part of Russia, and Ukraine must recognize the occupied pieces of Donbas as independent statelets. And this struck the Ukrainians very much as capitulation. They were not interested. In September of 2022, Putin actually hardens his demands. So he then claims that not only must Ukraine recognize Crimea as Russia, Ukraine must recognize Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhzhia, and Kherson, those four provinces in the east and the south, as Russian territory. And that was interesting because at that point on the time, the Russian army had been losing on the battlefield for about 2 months, and Russia did not occupy all of any of these four provinces that Putin now claimed to annex. In 2024, the Russians begin to say also that for this war to end, we must eliminate the root causes. And one root cause appears to be a Ukraine that wants the independence to choose its own foreign policy course and its own domestic policies. So I think if you look at the Russian negotiating position over the past 4.5 years, if it's changed, it's only hardened. There's not been a serious Russian effort to negotiate. Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president pictured here, in 2023, he had, I think, three basic demands. Russia withdrawal from all of Ukraine, including Crimea. Compensation for the damage done to Ukraine, and the estimate now is somewhere between $500 billion and $1 trillion. And war criminals being brought to account, which is awkward for the Kremlin because Vladimir Putin has been indicted by the International Criminal Court for the war crime of taking Ukrainian children and moving them out of occupied Ukraine back to Russia. Now, I think Zelensky's demands are perfectly justified, but probably not realistic. The last couple of years when I've been in Ukraine, I've come to the conclusion Ukrainians are weary of the war. They want it to end. They are perhaps prepared to make significant concessions to end it, but they're not going to give away the store. And so my view was that Ukrainians could perhaps accept the de facto loss of the territory occupied by Russia, but only if they had very solid security guarantees. And it explained to a couple of Ukrainians, they said, we do not want a situation where we settle with Russia today, and then Putin uses 2 or 3 years to regenerate his military, and then we're back at war with the Russians. Now, let me talk a little bit about the American attitude on negotiations. I'll start with the Biden administration, President Biden talking about Ukraine. The Biden administration from the beginning in 2022 set two goals. One was to help Ukraine. The other was to avoid a direct NATO-Russia military clash. And those were by far the right two goals. But where I became increasingly critical of the Biden administration is in balancing those goals, I thought they were overly conservative. They were more conservative than they needed to be given Russian policy. But the Biden administration sent significant resources. So this is from 2022 until the end of 2024. The European Union supplied about 113 billion euros to Ukraine. The United States provided about 114 billion euros. That's about $130 billion. The bulk of American assistance was military, which was critically important for the Ukrainians. But the Biden administration also had a very specific position on Ukraine in negotiations. They said there should be no negotiations about Ukraine without Ukraine at the table. And they also said it's up to Ukraine to determine when negotiations make sense, when they think that the Russians are going to negotiate in a serious way. Now, the Trump administration brought a very different approach. As you can see in this chart, blue is assistance from Europe, orange is assistance from the United States, and basically in 2025, the Trump administration zeroed out military, financial, and humanitarian aid for Ukraine. And this is where, fortunately for Ukraine, Europe stepped up. So in this spring, Europe agreed on a 90 billion euro, that's about $115 billion loan to Ukraine, which should keep them going well into 2027. And I think the Europeans recognize, in a way that I think key leaders in the United States do not recognize, that what happens in Ukraine is directly going to impact their security. Now, the Trump administration rolled out their approach, or began rolling out their approach, to mediating a solution to this war in February of 2025. President Trump and Secretary of Defense Hegseth, shown here in February, though, began to take certain positions. One is they said, well, Ukraine cannot hope to regain all of its territory. And they said, Ukraine can't join NATO. And that strikes me as odd. I mean, if you're trying to mediate a conflict, it was odd that the Trump administration was taking positions on two issues very key to Russia, before the sides had even agreed to negotiate or to mediate. I think it's become very clear, and it was clear a year ago, that Vladimir Putin would much prefer to negotiate this war with Donald Trump, not with Volodymyr Zelensky. And I think that's because Putin concludes correctly that Mr. Trump wants a settlement, but he doesn't care about the details. He doesn't care about the impact. And although Mr. Trump several times, I think five times by my account, expressed frustration with the Russians back in the spring of 2025, there were five times where he said, I'm going to give Russia a couple weeks more to accept a ceasefire. The Russians never agreed to a ceasefire. Then, of course, in August, you had the meeting in Alaska between Trump and Putin. On the way to this meeting on Air Force One, Mr. Trump told journalists, I'm going to insist that Putin agree to a ceasefire, and if he does not, there will be severe consequences for Russia. Well, in the event, Putin did not agree to a ceasefire. There were no consequences. Instead, the sides talked about an understanding, and it appears that Mr. Trump and Putin were negotiating about Ukraine without the Ukrainians there. And I think Putin has sort of figured this out. Putin understands that he can ignore American demands on the Russia-Ukraine war, and there are no consequences. And that is not the way to deal with the Kremlin. So on negotiating prospects looking forward, I think the Russian position remains essentially the same. While the Ukrainians have shown some flexibility on territory, but they also want very strong security guarantees. There were a flurry of meetings that took place at the end of last year, and they were really triggered in November when the American negotiator Steven Witkoff met with his Russian counterpart and produced a 28-point plan for settling the war. And those 28 points, I think most people felt, very much favored the Russians. There were then a string of negotiations that took place among Americans, Ukrainians, and Europeans in December of last year and January of this year, which basically reduced those 28 points to 20 and eliminated most of the damaging points for Ukraine. However, with lack of progress, Secretary of State Rubio here basically in May said, we're going to pause the American mediation effort. I actually think that that is not a bad thing. First of all, I think we've seen over the past year and a half, Mr. Trump has an instinctively pro-Russian bias. Second, his chief negotiator, Steven Witkoff, has been to Moscow 8 times in the last 16, 18 months and has not yet been to Kyiv. And I do not understand how you negotiate a settlement between two warring parties when you only seem interested in talking to one of them. But third, I think most importantly, Mr. Trump has not been prepared to use the leverage that he has to put pressure on Putin to force Putin to negotiate in a more serious way. And so we have a situation now where the mediation effort is not succeeding. Now, over the last 5 or 6 weeks, Mr. Trump's rhetoric seemed to change. At a meeting in June, he said, I'm prepared now to license Ukraine to build their own Patriot missiles. 5 weeks later, he walked that back. And he now seems to be back to saying it's not Russia that has to move, but the onus for a settlement is on Zelensky. And again, I do not see a change in the prospects for the American mediation effort until such time as there's a readiness on the American part to put more pressure on the Russians. Now, I think the Ukrainians, for their part, they're not going to trash the relationship with the United States, but they understand that the mediation effort has failed. To put it in terminology that Mr. Trump uses, the United States has many fewer cards with Ukraine than it used to. In the Biden administration, when you're providing $30 to $35 billion a year in assistance, you know, that gives you a say in Kyiv. We're not doing that any longer. And there's now, I think, some evidence that Ukraine is trying to move forward with the Europeans. So this is a meeting that took place, I think, in June between Zelensky and leaders of Britain, France, and Germany. And they came out with 5 demands or 5 conditions they thought for settling the war. One was an immediate and comprehensive ceasefire. Second was taking the line of contact as the basis for any negotiation, including on territory. Third was that Ukraine should have robust and legally binding security guarantees. 4, that Russian frozen central bank assets, we're talking about $300 billion, should not be returned to Russia until Russia compensates Ukraine for the damage done. And then 5th, that any settlement needs to take a look at the wider implications for European security. It seems to me that a serious negotiation is going to require that Moscow adjust its approach. And then there really are these two big issues. One is the question of territory. So again, this shows what Russia now occupies. I think Ukrainians, or many Ukrainians, are prepared to accept the loss of that territory on a de facto basis. Now they say, we're not going to recognize it legally, we're never going to say this is Russian, but you know, they seem to be prepared to accept that on a de facto basis. But the Russians want more. So that yellow part there in the northwest part of Donetsk province, this is what Vice President Vance refers to as a few square kilometers. It's actually 5,000 square kilometers, 2,000 square miles, and it's not empty land. 200,000 Ukrainians live on that territory, and they do not want to be Russian. And that land also houses important defensive fortifications, which have stopped the Russian advance now for more than 4 years. Ukraine is not going to simply hand over land that the Russians do not and have never occupied. And so that's a territorial issue. The other issue, I think, is security guarantees, and there are several possibilities. I personally think that the best guarantee would be NATO membership, and a Ukraine in NATO would be not just a consumer of security. It has the largest, best-trained, most battle-hardened military in Europe now. It would be a contributor to NATO security, but I think that that is not going to happen in the short term. About 25 countries have offered Ukraine bilateral security guarantees. Those are welcome in Kyiv, but no country has yet committed that if the Russians were to invade again, I will send forces to your defense. The British and the French have talked since early last year about a coalition of the willing that would put together a force of maybe 10 to 20,000 troops that would go after a settlement, be on the ground deployed in Ukraine to reassure the Ukrainians. However, the British and French have said, we need to have an American backstop, an assurance that if that force were to come under Russian attack, that the United States would respond. Now, a year ago, in an interview, Mr. Trump suggested that he would be prepared to commit American air power to their defense. But the fact that we haven't heard anything about that for a year now suggests to me that maybe that commitment was then taken back. But I think the other part of the security guarantee is helping Ukraine build a large modern military that on its own can do a lot to deter the Russians. So if you have that and a combination of some Western security guarantees, that may provide what you need in that area. But the problem for these negotiations on territory or on security is that Vladimir Putin still appears to believe he can achieve his goals on the battlefield. And you have to find a way to disabuse him of that notion. And I think the goal of the West working with Ukraine should be to persuade Putin that if he continues to try to win on the battlefield, he will not succeed, and he will only face growing, increasing political, military, and economic costs. And that might create a chance to lead to a new approach by the Russians. So again, I think in this picture, you know, Mr. Trump's ability to deal with Zelensky and Putin, if he wants to mediate, there are several things he could do. He could find a way to provide some more Patriot missiles, interceptors to Ukraine. He could tighten the sanctions regime. It was encouraging that the Senate has now voted through legislation, which includes the possibility of secondary sanctions on those countries that still purchase energy from Russia. However, I would note that the legislation does not require the president to do anything. It only authorizes him to do things. And if Mr. Trump wanted to send a really stark message to Putin, he could ask Congress for $20 billion in assistance to Ukraine. But I think the big question is Mr. Trump going to use this leverage based on the last 18 months? I think the answer is probably and unfortunately no. And that means the mediation effort, which has failed to date, will not succeed. To be sure, the Russians have a larger economy. They have more people. But I would not underestimate the Ukrainians' determination. The Ukrainians view this war as existential in a way that Russians do not. And I think while the Ukrainians are prepared to accept a durable settlement that might require painful decisions by Ukrainians, they're not prepared to do a deal if the Russians will make no compromises. And they are prepared, I believe, to fight on, and this war will continue. So unfortunately, absent a change of American policy, I don't think we're talking about a negotiated settlement in the near term. We're talking about a continuing war. And at this point, I would be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Steve. Very sobering, I have to say. I always take the advantage of being the moderator to ask the first question. You talked a lot about the Ukrainian need for Western support. Could you talk a little bit about whether Russia needs outside support for their effort from North Korea, from China, whatever?
I think Russia actually has found that they cannot prosecute this war on their own. They're getting a lot of economic support from China and components, although thus far it does not appear that the Chinese are providing weapons. China, I think, is selling to both sides because a lot of the components that the Ukrainians use in their drones actually are produced in China. Then there's also the support now we see from North Korea. In fact, the North Koreans deployed a division of troops to Russia about 2 years ago. Those forces were used as part of the Russian counteroffensive to push the Ukrainians out when the Ukrainians occupied a part of Russian territory in Kursk. Although as far as we know, they never actually entered Ukrainian territory. The North Koreans have also been very critical in supplying the Russians with artillery and now some ballistic missiles. And there's talk about the North Koreans perhaps providing additional troops. Although thus far over the past year, I think we've seen the people that North Korea are providing tend to be more in the labor force. We're not yet seeing that the North Koreans showing up on the battlefield in Ukraine, and I would hope that would not happen, but I would not be surprised if it did.
Someone wants to know whether there's a tipping point for Russian casualties. Yeah. Is there a point at which Putin is just going to say enough is enough?
I hope so, but I have to tell you, if you'd asked me back in 2022, I would have said 1.4 million casualties, 500,000 killed, would have passed that limit. I mean, Putin has built a situation where it's a very authoritarian regime, but it's interesting in that the Kremlin still, I think, pays significant attention to public opinion. And the question is, have we reached a point where the Russian public has turned against this war? And I think the polling, and to the extent that you can trust polling in Russia now, gives you an ambiguous picture. Because on the one hand, the polling says that the Russian people largely support Putin. But on the other hand, the Russian polling also says that the Russians would welcome a negotiated settlement end of the war. But it hasn't yet manifested itself in a real push against the Kremlin to end the war. One time I was in Kyiv and the Ukrainians said, if it reaches the point, and they note that a lot of the casualties now, and I can't prove this, but I think anecdotally, a lot of the casualties actually come from non-ethnic Russian populations, Buryats from the Far East, Dagestanis. But in Kyiv, they were thinking if it reaches a point where Putin has to begin drafting ethnic Russians in Moscow and St. Petersburg, at that point, the Russian public may begin to have a new attitude about the war.
So what's the possibility of Putin being removed from office?
I'd say non-zero, but not very high. I do wonder if some people in the inner circle who are not as obsessed with Ukraine as Putin appears to be are beginning to question what this war means for Russia. But if you're that person and you can't do it on your own, how do you approach somebody else? That could be a question that you ask of somebody else that could be very impactful for your future career. So I think you have, Putin's built up a situation designed to protect him, but I also would not totally exclude it. Remember, there have been surprises in Russian politics.
Here's someone who remembers that there were some guarantees or assurances given to Russia, or given to Ukraine when Russia took over Crimea. And what happened to these security guarantees? Yeah. When they gave up their nuclear weapons.
Okay, yeah, this actually goes back to 1994. Part of the settlement under which Ukraine agreed to give up the nuclear weapons on its territory was the Budapest Memorandum on Security Assurances, which I helped negotiate. Now, a couple of points about that. If you read the assurances, what they say is the United States, Russia, and Britain commit to respect Ukraine's sovereignty, its territorial integrity, its independence, and they commit not to use force or threaten to use force against Ukraine. Now, there's nothing in the memorandum that says if Russia violates those commitments, United States and Britain will do X. Now, having said that, I also think in the negotiating record in 1993 and 1994, when Ukrainians asked us, what will you Americans do if the Russians violate these commitments? Now, we told the Ukrainians, look, we're telling you now, we're not going to send the 82nd Airborne. So it was very important to us that it's the memorandum of security assurances, not security guarantees. Because guarantees to an American diplomatic ears means something like NATO. But we did say, we will do things, we will support you. Now, a mistake was made in that in 1994, nobody really foresaw what was going to happen in 2014 or 2022. So we didn't have an extended conversation, and that was a failure both in Washington but also in Kyiv. I mean, had it the Ukrainians seen in 1994 what the Russians were going to do in 2022, their demands for that memorandum would have been much heavier and probably beyond what the United States could have agreed to. So I think going back to the negotiating record, I was critical of the Obama administration for not doing more after Ukraine lost Crimea, after Russia seized Crimea. But I do think that the Biden administration providing $30 to $35 billion per year to Ukraine, organizing sanctions efforts on Russia, and putting other diplomatic pressure on Russia, I think that was consistent with what we told the Ukrainians 30 years ago.
Then there's quite a number of questions about the nuclear option. Yeah. How close is Russia to the nuclear option in Ukraine?
Yeah. Again, I wouldn't rule out, but I actually think that the chances are very, very small. And I go back to, I think, the case in September of 2022, where I showed that map where Russia annexed, or Putin said, we've now annexed Kherson, Zaporizhia, Luhansk, and Donetsk. And then Putin said, you know, we will defend this as Russian territory with all means at our disposal. And that caused people to ask, is Putin making a nuclear threat? I was told by people in the Biden administration that there was one intelligence estimate that said 50% chance of Russia using tactical nuclear weapons against Ukraine. Well, what happened? First of all, the Ukrainians kept fighting. The Ukrainians already see this war as existential. And I don't think the prospect of tactical nuclear weapons was going to change that. Second, the United States, Britain, and France sent very sharp private messages to Moscow saying, if you use nuclear weapons in this conflict, there will be severe or catastrophic consequences for Russia. Full stop, let the Russians figure out what that would mean. But I think also there were reports that both the Chinese and the Indians weighed in October of 2022 saying, you can't do this. You start a conventional war, and then you can't win at that level, then you go to the nuclear option. And what was interesting to me was already at the end of October, Putin backs away from the threat. So every year he meets with this group called the Valdai Discussion Club, which used to have a lot more Western experts. That number is reduced. But he gets the question, what about these nuclear threats? And Putin says, no, we don't make nuclear threats. That is not consistent with Russian doctrine. Basically, this is the West trying to tarnish our good reputation. A week later, the Russian Foreign Ministry puts out a statement on prevention of nuclear war, which is 95% of what we in the West would want the Russians to say about that. And then a few weeks after that, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, is representing Russia at the G20 summit in Bali and signs on to language saying nuclear threats are inadmissible and unacceptable. Then after that, Putin's rhetoric really kind of moderates. Then there was 2024 in the fall where Putin says, well, we're going to change our military doctrine. And one part of Russian military doctrine used to say that Russia would use nuclear weapons in the event of a conventional attack on Russia that put the existence of the Russian state at stake. From my mind, that condition, it's clear, it's very plausible, it's understandable. Well, the Russians then changed that to say, Russia will use nuclear weapons if there is a conventional attack on Russia that calls into question Russian sovereignty or territorial integrity. And I have no idea what that means. The Russians issued that doctrinal change at a time when the Ukrainian military was occupying part of Russian territory in Kursk, and the Ukrainians were just ramping up long-range strikes into Russia, and there was no Russian response. So I think the Russians, I don't think Putin wants a nuclear war, but he wants us to think that he may be headed in that direction, try to intimidate us, and this is an area where we in the West should choose not to be intimidated.
How close are the Ukrainians to producing their own long-range ballistic missiles?
Some are talking about it by the end of this year. One has to remember that in Dnipro, the largest ballistic missile facility production, largest ballistic missile production facility in the world was in Dnipro in Ukraine. Yeah. And a lot of that's gone now, but I think the Ukrainians still have some memory and they are now trying to build ballistic missiles. They've started to augment their long-range drones with cruise missiles. In fact, their cruise missile has, I think, double the payload of an American Tomahawk missile in longer range. But it's a bigger missile, so it's a more obvious target on a radar. But you now have Ukrainians talking about, can they revive some of the technologies and begin to have the capability to conduct ballistic missile strikes deep into Russia?
And then maybe one last question here. The war has shown how innovative the Ukrainian people are and can be in the future. If there is a peace, how do you see the rebuilding of Ukraine progressing? Is it going to be a long road to hoe, and will the Europeans help?
Yeah, I think it depends on the nature of the peace. If there's a peaceful settlement where the Ukrainians are confident that, you know, the Russians are not going to invade again in another 2 or 3 years, and the West sees that, I think there are some significant investment opportunities. And I think the Ukrainians, they've shown themselves under wartime conditions to be incredibly innovative. If they can then sort of mobilize some of that innovation on the economic side, it would, I think, enable the reconstruction of Ukraine at a much faster pace. And as I completely agree with the conditions that were put forward by the European leaders and Zelensky, is that part of that reconstruction should be funded either by Russian compensation or by seizure of the $300 billion in Russian frozen central bank assets that now sit in Western institutions.
Well, I thank you very much.
Thank you.